Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 4 months after an oil train derailed and caught fire in the Columbia Gorge town of Mosier, the Wasco County Planning Commission has approved a proposal by Union Pacific to expand its rail facilities through Mosier at the very site of the derailment in June. According to rail traffic experts retained by Friends of the Columbia Gorge, the rail expansion project could result in a major increase in rail traffic and oil trains through the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. This morning, we talk with Friends of the Columbia Gorge's staff attorney, Steve McCoy, about how oil trains have come to be a fixture through the gorge and what the future outlook is for this project. Steve, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara.
Let's start by talking about why there are oil trains going through the gorge. I mean, this is something that is relatively new, and what's brought this to be about?
Sure. So, of course, there are the Bakken oil fields in the Dakotas where there is a significant amount of what they call tight oil that can be exploited by fracking. So the fracking takes place in North Dakota. The oil is then, you know, pumped to the surface and loaded on trains. Those trains then travel to, various places. They travel all over the United States. But in particular, the ones that go through the gorge are generally traveling to port areas along the Pacific Northwest and in Seattle in particular. Quite a bit of that oil is actually used in refineries up in the Seattle area. And then also there are some facilities that use oil as well in the city of Portland.
So how long has this been going on that we've been having these oil trains going through our region?
So it's been about 3 years now. Well, so for Union Pacific, it's been a shorter amount of time than for BNSF. BNSF has been doing it for several years. And
they're doing it across the river in Washington.
So, right? Correct, yes. So, the way that it works is that BNSF has tracks on the north side of the Columbia, and UP has tracks on the south side of Columbia.
So, and this is something that's now a concern in communities around the country. In fact, I have a friend who's the mayor of San Luis Obispo, and she got together with Arlene Burns, who's the mayor of Mosier, a few months ago, right after the fire in Mosier. And they were at basically a conference of mayors that were trying to deal with I think they were dealing specifically with the Phillips 66 proposal to build a big oil terminal right near San Luis Obispo. And it seems to me this is a universal concern around the country. How has it happened that communities are suddenly finding themselves being the thoroughfare for oil trains and at risk of having fiery explosions like the one that happened in Mosier on June 3rd?
Yeah, so it's really pretty amazing that so the tracks have been running through these cities for a long time. And you see cities up and down the gorge, as well as other places in the Pacific Northwest, that now have become extremely concerned because of these oil trains and because they're very heavy. They slosh around whenever they speed up and slow down. And so they're much more likely to derail than other types of trains. And they carry a commodity that is explosive. I think that's where the concern is stemming from, is though hazardous materials have been moving through for a long time, now they're seeing something that is kind of another level of danger and much more identifiable as well.
Well, I think we all have that image of the Quebec town of Lac Mégantic that was blown away a couple of years ago. Was it 4 years ago now? And is it four? Yes, I think so.
Three, yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. Three years ago, yeah. 2013. And that was, when I heard on June 3rd that an oil train had derailed in Mosier and there was a fire, and before I got the full information, I was imagining Mosier going the way of Lac Mégantic. And if I were to live in Mosier, I mean, I feel emotionally connected to it without having to live there, as I think we do with every community throughout the gorge. But I would imagine that it's terrifying to have these trains going through. And how many times a week do these trains go through towns like Mosier and the Gorge?
So on the south side of the river, it's not very often, actually. It's up to about three trains a week. So there aren't a whole lot of trains going through, but since they are heavy and since they do slosh around and since there are many, many curves in the gorge, they are particularly dangerous. On the north side of the river, it's significantly more than that. I don't know the number offhand.
But there are several a day, I think, actually.
Yeah, I think so, and for BNSF.
Yeah. I was actually, I'm doing a radio documentary now about the oil trains and the whole pressure of building a fossil fuel infrastructure here in the Northwest, like particularly the infamous terminal in Vancouver that's being proposed. And I was told by one of the anti-fossil fuel activists in Vancouver, as I wanted to get some sounds of the train, she gave me the times, and like this, like two or three times a day, when she knows they're going to go by through Vancouver. So right. it is like, and so I guess that's another stark difference between the Oregon side of the gorge and the Washington side of the gorge. How might this change, though, with some proposals that the railroad has been working on for a number of years?
Yeah, well, so there are also oil fields. So the reason that BNSF has so many more trains going through is because the way that their tracks are laid out, they have many more tracks up in the Dakotas. So it's a lot easier for them to take oil from the Dakotas and bring it through the gorge. However, UP serves Utah very well. And there's a significant amount of oil production, oil development that's going on there as well. So it's very likely that oil trains coming from Utah instead of from the Dakotas will be going on the south side of the gorge as, of course, the oil export ban was rescinded.
Actually, let's back up a little bit, because a lot of people don't even know that we had an oil export ban. So let's go back 30 years. Or whatever.
40 years.
40
yeah.
years, okay.
Yeah, so for 40 years, there was a ban on exporting oil from the United States.
And that came out of the oil embargo, I believe, in 1973?
Exactly, yeah. It came from OPEC 1 and OPEC 2, the two big oil shocks that happened in the 70s. Of course, oil could be exchanged with Canada and with Mexico, but exporting it overseas, it was what the export ban really, really reached. So in the last budget at the end of 2015, that then went into effect at the beginning of 2016, Congress slipped in there, stuffed in there provisions so that the oil export ban would be rescinded. Then, of course, the president ultimately sign that. And so people see dollar signs now. Gosh, we've got all this oil in the Dakotas that we're pulling out of the ground. We've got new production in Utah. We've got new production in various oil fields because of fracking. And now we've got markets. So that's really where we expect to see with oil terminals popping up in the Pacific Northwest, that's really where we expect to see the demand.
Actually, I got a strange sense about this kind of imbalance of oil. I saw a headline last week that Venezuela may be importing oil from the United States.
Wow.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't. That's amazing. After years of being such a large producer.
It's not. They still have the oil. Their infrastructure is completely falling apart.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But I think that's an interesting, I mean, that's a whole other story, a whole other show we could do on. But it gives a sense of just the glut of oil that is being created by all the fracking that's going on. And we could also talk about the climate change impacts of that. But is it really such a case that we don't need our domestic oil anymore after all these years of saying that we needed to be free of foreign oil?
Well, you know, there's a finite amount of oil in the world. And it's really where you can get it the cheapest. So the cheapest producer is going to make the most money. And of course, fracking and, also, of course, the tar sands up in Alberta, those are not the cheapest producers. But whenever oil prices are high enough, they can produce and they can pull more oil out. And if they do so, they can make money.
Because oil hasn't been exactly high priced for the last couple of years, though. I did think it went up last week, I think.
Yeah, I think it's up above $50 again. But
that's a long cry. I mean, it's $100 a barrel is what I understand is the break-even point for tar sands, and I'm not sure if it's much less for fracking.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the exact amounts are. So, but once you start producing, it's hard to stop producing also. So you need markets so that you can to soak up that oil.
So that's another big shift between what's happening now and what happened for the last 40 years, that there is all this oil that's being produced, as well as natural gas, which is why we're seeing all this pressure for LNG terminals up and down the West Coast.
Right, right. And that's another outcome of fracking is we get a lot more natural gas.
So this is because there's so much oil, all of a sudden we're seeing these trains going through our communities. And I guess one other thing I wanted to ask, you said this oil that's potentially, or is it already coming out of Utah? And I know that there's been plans to start doing, producing oil, well, start mining the oil tar sands fields in Utah. And I'm wondering if that's in place now, and that's where the oil that's coming from Utah is now tar sands oil.
My understanding is it's coming from the Uinta Basin. I used to backpack up in that area, and there were, at that time, oil derricks there to some degree. And I think that's really exploded now.
So it's
actually not
oil.
The bitumen that they're doing right now there. It's really more of the fracking
It's not conventional, it's fracking. It's the same. Yeah. I wonder, they were also talking about fracking in northeastern Utah, and this was like 12, 15 years ago. I wonder if that's...
So northeastern Utah is where the Uinta Basin is.
Right. Okay, that's right. Actually, I talked to some tribes back in 99, and they were very concerned about fracking at that point and talked about it in a violation of all of their cultural, their heritage and their values. But it looks like they lost out.
Yeah. Perhaps they did, yeah.
So actually, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Steve McCoy, who's the staff attorney for Friends of the Columbia Gorge and who is in coalition with a number of different environmental groups putting pressure on Wasco County to prevent an expansion of rails through Wasco County and in particular through the community of Mosier so that oil train traffic will not be increased above 3 or 4 cars or trains a week. Let's talk about this contradiction. I mean, I know that when the derailment happened in Mosier on June 3rd, at the rally I went to the next couple of days, there was talk about how people had to stop this proposed expansion of the rails. So this is something that's been in the works for a while. And I guess a lot of people would ask, why didn't it just be put to bed after the train derailed?
Well, so the way that Union Pacific plays it, what they are saying is that it will improve fluidity of the trains going through the area, and that it's really not for an expansion. It's not for bringing more trains through. They also call it the biggest bottleneck in the 206 miles between Hinkle, Oregon and Portland, Oregon. So I think, frankly, what's happening here is they see dollar signs. They say, well, gosh, we can really increase traffic. That's what our traffic experts that we retained have told us, that this would significantly increase the number of trains that could travel through the gorge by 2 trains an hour. I think that's it. That's what Union Pacific is seeing is, gosh, we can increase the throughput, increase the number of trains that can go through the gorge, and then we'll be poised to soak up the oil trains. We'll be poised to serve that market.
Well, you said that they're saying this isn't really about increasing traffic. Opening up a bottleneck. So what is this bottleneck that exists around Mosier that needs to be opened up?
So let's talk about sidings and mainline tracks for a second. So sidings are where trains pull over and let another train pass. They might move slowly. They might actually stop and idle. A double mainline track, which is what is being proposed here, is where 2 trains pass at speed. So what this would do would be allow what they talk about industry standard train lengths, which means a mile and a half long or even longer. Right now, they can't easily run those through the gorge because there are not enough sidings that are long enough. And really between the Dalles and I think around Troutdale, there aren't double mainline tracks where they can pass at speed. So this would allow them to pass at speed there. And in fact, it would be an unusually long double mainline track. So there's already a siding there that's a little over a mile long. They want to add 4 additional miles to that. So it would be 5 miles then that the 2 trains could pass at speed.
Now, is this right at Mosier or is it?
It is on... So the 4 miles they want to do, 2 miles is on the east of Mosier and 2 miles is on the west of Mosier. The siding ends right around where the derailment was. So they will actually have to double track exactly where the accident took place in June.
So is there any way that they could justify that this will make things safer?
That's really not something that the railroad has said that this would make things safer. They do talk about, idling, they talk about moving trains being safe trains, which when they said that at the hearing, there was a lot of laughter from folks. They do say, if there is any safety benefit, it's that there won't be trains stopped on the siding in Mosier that people could, get on, and then when it starts back up, get hurt. However, as far as, rail safety, as far as, fixing things, of course, the Federal Railroad Administration, a few days after the accident, came out and said, this was not an accident. It was a failure for UP to maintain their tracks appropriately. So they're not saying, this is going to make us maintain our tracks appropriately. It's not going to be safer for that reason. It's just, if there's any safety benefit, it's that there won't be idling trains there.
So when this was being proposed to the county, what was the county's response?
Okay, so this has been going on for, since 2014. And initially the county's response was, you've presented us with an incomplete application for the permits. So, backing up a little bit, what are they asking for? What permits are they asking for? So the, Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area, is a federally created area, of course. And there are a set of laws that are unique to that area. And local governments, so each of the counties, the six counties in that are in the Columbia River Gorge, they have their own local land use laws that implement the federal law. So and those are to protect, four things: the scenic resources, the recreation resources, the natural resources, and the cultural resources of the gorge. So the railroad needs a permit. Railroad needs a permit under the county in this case, the county land use and development ordinance that implements the federal act. And they need that permit to do their construction. So they approached the county, said, hey, we need this permit. Here's our application. The county went back and forth with them several times saying, this is incomplete and here are the reasons it's incomplete. And the railroad kept giving them more information. And eventually the planning director said, this is a complete application. We will begin processing it now. They began processing it. It got stalled several times for various reasons. Then there was supposed to be a hearing on June 6th of this year. Of course, June 3rd, the incident happened. The hearing was postponed until July 5th. So the day after the 4th of July, things were still too hot at that point. So then it was postponed until the day after Labor Day. So it seems like they were going after vacation weeks or something. I don't know. A tremendous number of people turned out for the hearing. Nobody spoke in favor of the proposal except for UP employees. I don't know the number offhand, but I think it was somewhere around 80 people testified against it, just members of the public.
And then what happened?
So then what happened? The Planning Commission took it under consideration. They left the record open so that they could accept more evidence into the record and more argument into the record. They did that. And then they closed the record, and then there was a Planning Commission hearing last week on Monday, and they started off, and things looked pretty good, actually. There was they took a straw poll, and there were three of the commissioners that said that they would vote for denial, three other commissioners that said they wanted to approve it with conditions, and then there was another one that was kind of waffling and said, right now I'm kind of leaning towards approving with conditions. So from there, they went and took an official vote. whether they would deny it or not. That failed 3-4. And from there, they started talking about the conditions that were on the proposal. And actually, another thing happened in the meantime. The last submittal that the railroad had put in hadn't been included in the packet that went out to the Planning Commission. So they hadn't gotten an opportunity to read it. So they were given 20 minutes to read it there. And it was a treatise on why you can't place these conditions on the permit. So what the Planning Commission did then was talked about the conditions and struck several of the most important conditions.
What were these conditions?
So there were things like, well, in your application, you've said that you aren't going to increase the number of trains. However, there's evidence in the record that says this would significantly increase the capacity for trains. So we're going to hold you to that. We're going to hold you to what you applied for. Your application says you're not going to increase the number of trains. So a condition would be not increasing the number of trains. So that condition was struck. There was a condition about covering coal cars. There was a condition that, this one's kind of crazy, that it was struck. They have to follow the railroad safety rules that are set out by the Federal Railroad Administration.
Which, if they had followed those, there would have been no derailment in Mosier on June 3rd.
Yeah, I don't know if that's exactly accurate. And the reason I can't say for sure is because that particular accident was caused by the equipment that they were using. It was a particular type of lag bolt that they were using that couldn't be inspected. And since it couldn't be inspected, they didn't know when it failed. And it had failed for some time. It was rusted where the accident was. So where the bolt was broken was rusted. So it had obviously failed some time back. But their inspection and testing never revealed that there was a problem there. And interestingly enough, one of the things that came out at the first Planning Commission hearing was that they have not replaced those bolts throughout the gorge yet. Oil trains, other trains are running through the gorge right now, and their deadline, their self-imposed deadline, is October 15th to fix all those lag bolts. So up until those lag bolts are fixed, there's a time bomb in the gorge right now.
It's interesting.
It's shocking.
I was in Mosier when they were replacing those lag bolts, and it was a noisy process, seemed also like very time consuming because they were, I could see how much they did in the couple hours that I was in Mosier, and they had moved maybe 50 feet, something like that. So it would take a long time to do that whole stretch of the gorge.
So it's only on the curves that they had put the lag bolts. So they're traditional spikes and all the straight parts. So it's really only the curves that they need to replace them in.
But there's still a lot of curves.
There's still a lot of curves in the gorge, yes.
I was noticing, went out to Hood River a few days ago, and I was noticing on the way back at night how many curves there were on that road.
But it seems like you either wouldn't be running the oil trains through there if you knew that there was a problem still, or you would get every crew that you could possibly get working on those bolts as fast as possible and get it done.
So there's an issue, and this came up when I was talking to Arlene Burns after the derailment happened, about the fact that it seems like it's not even a question of federal versus local control, but it's really railroad versus everybody else's control. Because it seemed like the railroad actually tells the federal government what to do besides telling local communities what to do. So how can Wasco County actually stand up to Union Pacific when Union Pacific thinks that it's the one that calls all the shots?
So generally that is the case, that the railroads have very sweeping preemption over local laws. That's why actually Mosier doesn't really have a voice here, is because their local laws are preempted by federal railroad law. However, backing up to the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area Act being a federal law and how the county's land use and development ordinances implement that federal law. Well, the way that it works is, since these laws are children of federal law, instead of getting preempted in the way local laws do, they actually have to be what's called harmonized with the Federal Railroad laws. So what a court would do is they would look at the Federal Railroad law and they would look at the Gorge Act, and then they would say, well, gosh, you know, what parts of these can be read together and harmonized, and both of them implemented at the same time. So that's why this is a really unusual circumstance. Generally, local governments, county cities, do not have a voice.
Well, in your letter to the Wasco County Planning Commission, you cite a lot of concerns that the Gorge already has in terms of a lot of environmental impacts from industry. You don't cite it. You don't cite the specifics because I understand that a lot of the pollution from the Gorge is 2 points from it. One is the Three Mile Dairy at the east end of the Gorge. And the other one is China. Which we don't have a lot of jurisdiction over. But
correct. There are also a fair number of coal trains that BNSF runs through the Gorge, and those spew particulate matter, PM2.5, into the air.
By the way, what is PM2.5?
So it's a particulate matter that is tiny. It's 2.5, it's smaller than 2.5 microns.
And a micron is a thousandth of a millimeter. Is that correct?
Right. So you could line up 5 PM2.5 particles, and that would be about the width of a human hair. So we're talking really tiny stuff. You can't see it. It's not visible to the naked eye. And that's a concern also, is that, again, going back to Utah, and of course the Millennium Bulk Terminal that is currently under consideration in Longview to be a huge coal export facility. Well, Utah does a lot of coal mining as well. So UP would potentially run coal trains through on the south side of the Gorge. So backing up also to our comments, we've actually submitted 4 rounds of comments. So what you're looking at there is actually kind of a small piece of it. It's about 65, 70 pages of comments total. And most of those are legal reasons why the permit cannot be approved.
Now, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Steve McCoy, who's a staff attorney for Friends of Columbia Gorge. And we're talking this morning about Union Pacific's plans to expand their rail line through the Gorge, particularly through the area of Mosier, where their train derailed on June 3rd of this year. And in the last part of the program, I'd like to know what your plans are now that the Planning Commission has overwhelmingly approved this rail expansion.
So I actually can't give you a straight answer to that question, unfortunately. And the reason I can't is because, we would like to appeal it. And the appeal would go to the Wasco County Board of County Commissioners. Internal things have to be done before we can get an appeal approved, however. It has to go to our board, and our board has to approve it.
Your board meaning Friends of the Columbia Gorge.
Friends of the Columbia Gorge, yes.
And then how about all the – there's a bunch of different – I'd like to actually just cite all the other organizations. So also Columbia Riverkeepers in on this, the Lands Council, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and a group called STAND, which was a new one to me.
Yeah. So STAND used to be called Forest Ethics.
Okay. They're not new to me. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They've been around. They just changed their name. And yes, I mean, there are various different parties that are interested in potentially appealing this. Once our board approves it, which I have full faith that they will, then we have 15 days. We're in a 15-day appeal period right now. So that appeal period will end on October 14th. So by October 14th, we'll have to get our appeal in. Then the Board of County Commissioners will hold what's called a de novo hearing, which means that it'll be an open record and you can introduce new evidence and new argument at that point. And it'll be a full-on hearing. And then we will get our arguments in again and hopefully they will decline it.
So if they decline it, is it dead in the water, or does then Union Pacific go ahead and try to go over your head again?
Union Pacific at that point, I can't really speak for what they would do. Most likely, they would probably try to go to either federal court or to the Surface Transportation Board, which is the administrative body that oversees them for non-safety related things, and try to assert preemption and say, hey, this is a local law, it's preempted. We are confident that they would not get complete preemption. So we are confident that they do need these permits, but that's probably what they would do. For us, if it's approved again by the Board of County Commissioners, then we would appeal it to the Gorge Commission, which is, again, the child of federal law. It's an interstate compact commission. And from there, then it goes actually strangely into state court if the Gorge Commission were to approve it as well.
And then ultimately to the Supreme Court.
And then ultimately, potentially to the Supreme Court, yes.
It would be interesting if this got to the Supreme Court, particularly interesting depending on who's elected president next month.
But yes, yes, it would be. And, you know, I don't really have a good reading. I'm not a railroad law expert, so I don't have a good reading on where the Supreme Court stands on railroad law right now. But I have a pretty good idea of where they stand on environmental laws like the National Scenic Area Act.
Actually, where do they stand on that right now, particularly this 4-4 court that we have at the moment?
Yeah, yeah. So three that are very strong backers. And, you know, of course, Kennedy's the swing vote. And
he likes the woods, though, doesn't he, I think?
Yeah, he does. He's certainly not reliable for the conservation community.
So basically, there's only three. I mean, I would think there's four that would be supportive. Breyer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Sotomayor,
right,
and
yes,
and
correct,
Kagan.
Correct, yeah. Correct, correct. Yes, there are four that are supportive. Yeah.
It's 2016 then, now. It's no longer like 2012.
Yeah, yeah. I'm behind on my Supreme Court, I guess. Yeah. And of course, if it's a tie at the Supreme Court, then whatever the lower court decided stands. It's pretty complicated, really, how this all works because of the Gorge Act and the way that it is a federal law that gives some local control.
Well, it's interesting to me because this is kind of bringing in, it's a totally, probably legally something to do with it, but I'm thinking about the rights of nature, which is a concept that's being put forward by more and more environmental lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
But that this is one instance where, in fact, the rights of nature can maybe be put on equal standing with the rights of the railroads because of the uniqueness of the Gorge Act. Is this something that you're considering?
Well, so, you know, I think that's more of people that want to change either state or federal constitution to have rights of nature.
Almost like the Gorge Act, though it isn't really a rights of nature act. It's giving an elevated status to a natural area that it wouldn't have if it weren't a scenic area.
Exactly. Exactly. Precisely. So, yes, it stands with the same force of federal law as the federal railroad laws do. And that's really the unusual thing about this.
So what's your prognosis?
My prognosis is we are right on the law and we are going to win at some point.
And why do you say that?
The reason I say that is because, like I mentioned in our other sets of comments, there are dozens of areas where this application can't be lawfully approved. So stepping back to the four kind of things that are the cornerstones of the Gorge Act, the scenic resources, they are planning to degrade the scenic resource of the gorge. They're going to make things uglier. They can't do that. Natural resources. There's filling of about a half dozen wetlands. There's buffer zones for the river and for the wetlands that they want to intrude upon. They want to clear a 6.62 acre oak woodland, which, as you know, oak woodlands are a really important resource for lots of sensitive species. And
there's so few of them left.
And there's so few of them left. That's it, is that so many of them have been removed either for agriculture or for forestry. Or for urban development. And then the recreational resources. Well, they actually want to build this through Mimaloo State Park. And they have worked with Oregon Parks and Recreation Department attempting to get a land transfer, a part of Mimaloose State Park, to the railroad so that they can build this.
Oregon State Park's actually amenable to that?
So like most agencies in Oregon, there's kind of a Jekyll and Hyde. There are two different pieces. There's the Parks and Recreation Department, and then there's the Parks Commission. The Parks and Recreation Department was looking at it as a way to get additional river access. So they said, well, gosh, we could transfer this land and maybe get some more river access, because the railroads block river access to the public in a lot of parts of the gorge. So that was the way that they were looking at it. The Parks Commission then came along and said, no, this is a really bad idea. And so the Parks Commission, who holds sway over the Parks Department, said, no, we're not going to approve this land transfer. So then, that's a big mess right there, frankly. That's a big mess for the railroad. That's another huge hurdle that has been put in front of them.
And then there's cultural resources.
Then there's cultural resources, and that's the final one. And I kind of lump within there the treaty rights as well, because with more trains going through and with usual and accustomed fishing places that the treaty tribes can use, they have to cross the tracks. And with additional trains, it's more danger for them. And also, if the accident that happened in Mosier, it hadn't sheared off the manhole cover, and all the oil that dumped out, or not all the oil, but a lot of the oil that dumped out then went into the wastewater treatment plant, which then shut down.
And was contained. It was a cement container.
It was contained contained, which was just a tremendous stroke of luck for all of us, frankly. Because if it hadn't, then it would have run into Rock Creek and then into the Columbia. As it was, only a small amount of oil actually made it into the Columbia. But there were just so many things that happened that day that mitigated that wreck. If the wind had been blowing, normal wind out of the west, you would have seen more. There was this long train that was stopped that they couldn't move, and there were this big fire. And what happens to those train cars is that their gaskets melt eventually once they get hot enough, and then they begin to leak. And then that one burns, and then the next one burns, and then the next one burns, and the next one burns. So this, I think there were 96 cars on the train. That train would have been engulfed to a much larger degree.
If there had been wind.
If there had been the normal winds that were taking place the day before and the day after.
And actually, I was looking at a photograph. I think it's actually in your paper here, of it's from the tracks looking into Mosier, and you see the grade school right there.
Yep.
It's so chilling to see that.
It is.
To get a sense of just how close this fire was to that community.
Yeah. And just walking around Mosier and realizing, well, gosh, that's where the accident happened. There's a trailer park right next to that. There's a trailer park here, houses here, school here. It's terrifying. So the cultural resources, back to that,
right.
Let me finish that off really quick. So there were areas that the contractor that the railroad hired to do the cultural assessment, that they, there were blackberries, there was poison oak, and so they skipped areas of the cultural assessment because it was inconvenient, essentially. So that's another concern.
So, if listeners want to get involved, what's the next step that people can take?
So, unfortunately, the time for most public involvement has passed with this because the record is now closed. And it's only open to parties, to people that I told you about 80 people testified at the Planning Commission hearing. Each of those can submit more if they want to. But the general public can't right now. But what the general public can do is show up at the Board of County Commissioners hearing and show that, this is a really bad idea. Show that you do not support this.
And when is that?
Unfortunately, that hasn't been scheduled yet. We're thinking it's probably going to be November 1st. which unfortunately is my daughter's birthday.
But you'll be there.
So maybe she'll be there too. But that's what we're projecting right now, is that it will be November 1st.
Well, we'll stay in touch and we'll do another report on this probably after November 1st.
Okay, great.
So I want to thank you for joining us very much. I've been talking with Steve McCoy, who is he's the Friends of Columbia Gorge staff attorney, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll hear a rebroadcast of a show from last spring featuring Bill Bigelow and Tim Swinehart, co-editors of A People's Curriculum for the Earth. I'll be back live in 2 weeks, when my guest will be Michael Abelman, author of Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier. My engineer is Natasha Delapine. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Grateful Dead. Casey Jones, this is our new theme song for Oil Trains. Thanks for listening.
Driving that train, high on cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind, and know that notion just crossed my mind. This old engine makes it on time, leaves Central Station about a quarter to nine. It's River Junction at 17-2, at a quarter to ten, you know it's traveling again. Driving that train, I'm cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind, and you know that notion just crossed my mind. Switchman sleeping train 102 is on the wrong track and headed for you. Driving that train, pound cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind, and you know that notion just crossed my mind.